Counsel in the next case may come forward and get ready. The next case is In Re, the child of NLB. Counsel in the fourth case set for oral argument from Winona County may come forward and take their place at the tables and get ready for their arguments. I'll call the case once each of you is settled into place and has your papers out. The fourth case on today's oral argument calendar before this panel is case number A19-0927, In Re, the matter of the welfare of the child of NLB. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself. As you know, you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bruce Nelson. I'm with the Nelson Law Office in Winona, Minnesota. I represent the appellant in this case. The appellant is a mother whose rights to her child were involuntarily terminated. The facts in this case are unusual, I guess from my perspective. The termination of parental rights in this case was based entirely on an incident that occurred in 2013 involving a prior child of this mother. At that time of the prior incident with the prior child, the mother was suffering profoundly from mental illness and was suffering from delusions and was having difficulty distinguishing dreams from reality. She was had been hospitalized at that time, and at the time of the allegations involving a previous child, she was in an intensive residential treatment facility and was still suffering significantly from her symptoms. She confided in friends around that time that she may have inappropriately touched the child. And she ultimately contacted the child's father and told him the same thing. The upshot of what she told them was, I don't know for sure what happened here. I have these dreams, but I think I may have touched the child inappropriately. The child at that time was living with the father. The father reported this to the Crawford County, Wisconsin Department of Social Services, where the child and the father were living at that time. Again, this was in the fall of 2013. Crawford County initiated an investigation which resulted in a forensic interview of the child in La Crosse, Wisconsin. At this forensic interview, the child made no admission that any inappropriate touching had occurred. The child then returned to the father's care. My client, the appellant, was still in the intensive residential treatment facility and still struggling with their mental health. Approximately 5 weeks later, the woman who was living with father at that time reported to the father that the child had told her that he had been inappropriately touched. The child then reported this to the father, and the father again reported it to Crawford County Social Services. There was a second forensic interview, and after a period of time in that interview, the child agreed with the proposition of the interviewer that he'd been inappropriately touched. So based upon this, Crawford County, Wisconsin sent a notice to my client, who was still in this intensive residential treatment facility, that they had concluded that she had inappropriately touched the child. The mother had never, during the investigation, had been interviewed twice by a police officer and had not made any admissions. She appeared confused. She was upset. She was having trouble distinguishing dreams from reality. The notice was sent to my client at the intensive residential treatment facility. Her therapist, the director of facility, responded on her behalf, disputed the conclusion, informed the folks in Crawford County that this woman is profoundly mentally ill, and asked for a review on her behalf. Crawford County apparently conducted a review, which consisted of somebody else in the same department looking at the reporting and concluding, yes, in fact, this had occurred.
The district court order, though, I mean, I think, quite frankly, I think, Mr. Nelson, we have a good understanding of what the facts are that led up to sure. this. So, but one of the things when I read the district court's order in here, the district court in its conclusions of law also spends a great deal of time talking about palpable unfitness,
yes,
an issue that was never pled, and that talks about the history of mental illness separate and distinct from the allegations of abuse of the prior child.
That's correct.
Those are observations that I made that I can't really tie to the pleadings in the case, but I don't know that, I don't see that issue being specifically raised other than the issue that you claim that the case wasn't properly pled out to begin with.
That's correct, Your Honor. The case wasn't properly pled. The appropriate statutory allegations were not made in the complaint, and in the court's order, the statutory allegations are not properly cited as well. And so
the fact that it wasn't pled the way you think it ought to have been, did that somehow prejudice your client?
It does, in a sense that, you know, we don't have a clear understanding of what's being alleged, although,
well, you raise
or at least
the
grounds.
In your closing argument. I understand that. You raise the issue in your closing argument of the improper pleading, but you know, in any of the pretrial hearings leading up to this, did anybody ever flag this for the district court and say, hey, this is under section 0.501, that's a procedural statute, that's not section 0.301 that has the grounds for termination? Was that issue ever flagged for the district court before?
It was not before trial. However, it was argued and noted in the closing arguments, which were in writing to the court at the conclusion of the case. So the issue was raised. The judge did have notice, and it wasn't corrected. With respect to Your Honor's noting that there was a lot of discussion about palpable unfitness, you're correct. The respondent's focus in this case was almost entirely on the incident that occurred in 2013. And as soon as that was discovered, the respondent immediately moved to terminate parental rights without looking any further into what has was going on in this woman's life since 2013. There had been 5 years that had passed, and simply seized upon this allegation, said, well, okay, here's our permission to file TPR without providing any kind of effort to try and deal with whatever underlying concerns that there were. So my client had no opportunity to engage in any kind of case planning to demonstrate that she was in fact not palpably unfit. She was in fact in a good place at that time. Her mental health was stable. She had a home she was residing in. There are no allegations involving any abuse or neglect of the child at issue in this particular case at all. It was based entirely on what had happened with the previous child. So the trial court, is obligated to find by clear and convincing evidence at least one statutory grounds for termination and that termination would be in best interest of the child. We talked a little bit about one of the statutory grounds. The other ground that could be looked at in this case would be egregious harm to a child. And if you look at the record at trial, the evidence consisted almost entirely of a transcript of a forensic interview of this child in which there was an acknowledgement by the child that mom may have touched him inappropriately.
Not this child, the prior child.
The prior child, I'm sorry, and it does get confusing. We're talking 2013 now. The prior child, who's 5 years old at the time, again, during a second forensic interview, towards the interview saying, okay, yes, this happened. And there was no opportunity to evaluate the reliability of this child's statement. The forensic interviewer was not called as a witness at trial, so he was not available for cross-examination. There was a police officer that did testify at trial that observed the interview. The police officer specifically said, I'm not an expert in forensic interviewing. I can't tell you whether this was a reliable statement by the child or not. So that was the sum total of the evidence. That and some statements made by a profoundly mentally ill woman that was confused between dreams and reality and said, I may have touched my child.
Your argument is that that's not substantial evidence, doesn't meet the standard of proof necessary for termination?
That is correct. I think if that threshold is met, then this case should be sent back to Winona County to give this woman an opportunity to parent her child. The clear and convincing evidence was not presented at trial to reach this high burden that should be met to terminate a parent's parental rights. However, even if the court were to conclude that this one incident might have occurred, there's no pattern of conduct here under the palpably unfit statute that would support termination of parental rights. We're talking about one incident.
Unfitness was never even pled. So I don't know how that issue is even before us. If you look at the Supreme Court decisions that say if a ground isn't pled, it can't be the basis for termination.
I understand. The only reason I'm addressing it is because the judge in this case seemed to be thinking that that was an issue. I think more on point is the allegation that there was egregious harm inflicted on another child of the mother in this case.
Is that allegation properly pleaded in your view? Are you arguing it's not?
Well, again, I don't believe it's properly pleaded. I don't believe the judge properly addressed the statutory criteria.
Let me just focus on the pleading.
Sure.
Judge Flory has alluded to the case law about what is required to be in the petition. Did the county properly plead in their petition a claim for termination based on egregious harm to child one?
In my view, they did not, Your Honor. They were citing statutory grounds that were based on basically procedure, when the county would be in a position to move to immediate TPR without providing any opportunity for the parent to case plan.
That's true, but that procedure does talk about egregious harm in 503 subdivision 2A2, but there is an analogous basis for termination on the basis of egregious harm that's in 260C301 also. So the fact that they cited the wrong statute number but used the right term in both places, is that significant or not?
Well, from a practical standpoint, Your Honor, I think everybody understood what the county was trying to do here. It was not properly pled. That's a fact. And the court, in its decision, did not properly find the correct statutory criteria to terminate parental rights. If you're looking at it strictly from a procedural standpoint, it wasn't done correctly. Whether that's grounds for reversal, I would leave to this court.
If everybody knew about it going into the trial, why isn't the issue waived?
It wasn't explicitly waived. I don't think when you get into a TPR proceeding where there's some pretty short timelines, you don't necessarily have the time to look at some of the procedural aspects of the case. You're trying to deal with the substantive issues that are being alleged. So, and to get back to the statutory grounds, the grounds for termination, the court must not only find a statutory grounds, there has to be a best interest analysis here. And the court, again, did not give a full analysis as required by the Court of Appeals or by the Minnesota courts in doing that analysis. There didn't appear to be any specific evaluation of the interest in the trial, of the child in maintaining the parent-child relationship, or the interest in the mother in preserving that relationship, or of the potential special factors that would need to be taken into account on behalf of the child. So, the order in this case didn't, and the court in this case apparently didn't give full consideration to what's required to terminate parental rights by failing to do that specific analysis. The court did make reference to stability and in the order terminating parental rights that was a important factor to the court that this child would not have stability if parental rights were not terminated. Again, that issue wasn't really explored at trial. It was the harm that was alleged to have been caused by the mother that everybody had focused on, and the court finding regarding stability are based on evidence that really wasn't presented at trial to support that conclusion. The mother, there had been 5 years that had elapsed from the alleged incident to when the petition for termination of parental rights of the subsequent child was filed. And the respondent really didn't even look at that before they filed their petition for termination of parental rights about whether this woman was in a place where she could provide stability. In fact, the evidence at trial was specific that in the year prior to the termination of parental rights proceeding, she had been stable. She had a home. She was engaged in her mental health services. There was no concerns expressed at trial about her current circumstances at the time the TPR case commenced. And so the court's conclusion that there was no stability or the mother would not be able to provide stability was contradicted by that specific evidence in trial.
Is there any finding about the best interest of this child?
Arguably, no. It would appear that the court was focusing more on what happened with the previous child and what was happening at that time 5 years ago. The court's order appears to express a concern, again, that this particular child would be endangered by my client going forward because of her ability to provide a stable environment, which, again, was belied by the facts that were presented at trial. The court seemed to fixate on what had happened immediately after the incident occurred with the prior child, 2014, 2015, 2016, where at trial my client, when asked, acknowledged that she had been struggling. She struggled for a long time to come to grips with her mental illness. However, in 2018, she had been successful. The court, by finding that this woman would not be able to provide stability, was looking beyond the recent past at what had happened long ago. The courts should take people where they are and the condition that they're in at the time that there's a request to interfere with their parental rights and not simply fixate on what happened, you know, 5 years previously.
And there is a petition to terminate parental rights based upon a sibling being subjected to egregious harm. Does that abrogate the requirement that the court find that the current child's best interests are served by termination?
That can be considered, Your Honor. But there's a proof issue here. And usually when that's going on, there's a prior termination of parental rights to a previous child. That didn't happen here. Or there's a prior criminal conviction involving abuse of a child. That didn't happen here either.
My question is, even when there's egregious harm to a prior child, is the court still obligated as to the current child to make findings as to whether termination is in this child's best interest?
Absolutely, yes.
Did that occur here?
I don't believe so.
I do see on page 14 of the district court's order, paragraph 14, I see a one-sentence paragraph relating to best interests. Yep. Maybe if you can take a look at that, can you tell us, is that adequate or inadequate?
I don't have that available right now.
It says it's in the best interest of the child to terminate parental rights of the mother.
So it was a conclusory statement that the court had made.
It is what it is.
It's in the addendum to your blue brief. If you have your blue brief, it's in page 14 of the addendum, but paragraph 14.
Is there anywhere else in the findings or conclusions where the court demonstrates some basis for that determination?
Your Honor, in my view, the judge's summary of her view of what was going on at the time don't amount to that conclusion.
I mean, there was no memorandum attached to these findings and conclusions.
Correct.
That would explain finding 14, is there?
There is not, no.
Thank you. Your initial allotment of time has expired. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the county, you may approach and begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rebecca Church. I'm a Winona County Assistant County Attorney. I represent the respondent, Winona County Health and Human Services.
Did you at any time ask the court for leave to amend this petition to cite specific statutory grounds for termination?
Your Honor, I did not, and that was an error on my part. However, the question that was asked to counsel, was this ever brought up prior to his closing argument? It was not. It was never brought to the court's attention or the petition or the county's attention, inside of court or outside of court.
But that wouldn't have kept you from moving the court to amend it even at that point, would it?
You are correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, clarifying your question. You're asking if after I received his closing, if I could have asked to amend.
And the answer is you could have, but you didn't.
Yes, Your Honor.
Statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, counsel, how do you get around this fairly clear Supreme Court authority in the BJ-M case 744 Northwest 2nd 699 that basically says, when a statutory ground is not stated as a basis for termination in the county's petition, then there is no evidence upon which termination under this ground could be justified.
Yeah, Your Honor, I would say that there are two ways that could be argued that you could get around that. First of all, the statutes that were cited in the county's petition do talk about egregious harm and are very similar to 260C.301 subdivision 1. B6, and everyone knew what was going on. Mr. Nelson acknowledged that everybody knew what the county's position was, what the county's position was based on, and what we were moving forward on and why. Additionally, not bringing it up essentially is waiving the issue. Again, everybody knew what was going on. And so then it comes down to it's a clerical error.
I'd like to address both of those, but I mean, your first response is that everybody knew the issue, but the district court in its order did not ever, I mean, the district court in its order did not address the proper statute under .301 or the, you know, the principles that you've argued in your red brief. You've gone through the law about egregious harm, but you're doing that analysis for the first time. The district court did not do that, correct?
My position is the district court did do that. The district court did lay out egregious harm and probably unfit. The district court did look at egregious harm and did find egregious harm and did find that this mother is unfit to continue with the parent-child relationship. So even though ultimately and those statutes are cited in her order.
Well, but did the district court cite specifically the paragraph, subparagraph about egregious harm, .301 sub 1B6.
Your Honor.
I know there's a reference to .301 generally, but I don't recall a reference, and that's on page 10 of the order, but I don't recall any citation to what
she
subdivision 1B6.
Those were not specifically cited. Case law to them and case law reflecting on them were cited. But the actual statutes were not specifically cited. The statutes that were cited in the petition are what the court went back to.
Does it trouble you at all that finding or conclusion 14 is just a bare parroting of the statute without any analysis, or is there some analysis that I missed?
The county's position, Your Honor, is that the court did make that analysis starting on number 7. And so the court did talk about best interest, talked about examples of best interest. So perhaps the court did...
Business about relapsing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which page?
Talking about, so my pages are, it appears to be page 12. So starting...
Addendum 12.
I'm sorry.
Addendum 12, it looks like.
On the addendum, page 12, starting on 7 and going through 13 and then ultimately ending on page 14, does talk about and look at best interest. So perhaps best interest wasn't laid out like best interest of child, best interest of mother, competing best interests, but they are talked about and they are discussed what the best interests are and why this is in the best interest of the child.
So my question about that, counsel, I got two questions. Do you agree that nowhere in your petition did you allege palpable unfitness as a ground for termination? I'm looking at it here. It's paragraph 7. You allege egregious harm. And then you talk about sexual abuse of another child, all under .503.
Yes.
There's no mention whatsoever in your petition of palpable unfitness.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
So do you find it problematic that the district court analyzed palpable unfitness in its order?
I think the district court was looking at was looking at the case as a whole, was looking at the testimony as a whole. A mother testified quite extensively of what has been going on in her life for 5 years that wasn't laid out in the petition, that wasn't original information that was known when the petition was filed. Additionally,
but the Supreme Court has told us if you didn't allege palpable unfitness, it can't be a basis for termination. Yet the district court spends a fair amount of time talking about palpable unfitness. And that leads into my second question that I find troublesome in terms of how I read the district court's order, and maybe you can correct me if you can. But when you start on paragraph 7 of the conclusions of law, where the judge starts talking about best interests, that's done right after the court addresses palpable unfitness, and all of its best interest analysis is done in the context of palpable unfitness. To me, that's troublesome because it wasn't alleged. No one was given notice that they had to defend against palpable unfitness, but the district court brought it into the order.
The district court did bring it into the order, Your Honor. However, egregious harm is also very concerning and would be a reason for best interest. And egregious harm that she has done in the past is analyzed as to why this is in the child's best interest. So the order may look concerning, but it appears to be the order she was just processing the case.
Your second reason, in response to Judge Flory's earlier question about the pleading, your second reason is that it's been waived. But in the BJM case, this court decided the case on waiver, saying that the parent had waived it, but the Supreme Court reversed us on that. Is there some reason why waiver applies in this case, even though it did not apply in BJM?
I think that my understanding of the case law is that if something isn't brought up prior to the appeal, it can't be brought up on appeal. So this hadn't been brought up. They argue also constitution due process and that she wasn't given proper notice, a motion for a new trial or a motion to amend the orders, it would just went straight to appeal. So then I do believe that narrows what the Court of Appeal looks at.
Did the district court, you argue in your respondent's brief that the district court's termination is justified by two statutory grounds, one, egregious harm, also palpable unfitness. Did the district court actually rest its decision on palpable unfitness? I don't see anywhere in the conclusions of law where the district court says she is palpably unfit, and in the order for relief at pages 14 and 15, there's no mention of palpable unfitness. I obviously it's mentioned or discussed in the body of the order, but I'm unclear. I don't see a conclusion, either a ultimate finding or a conclusion of law that mother is palpably unfit, unless you can point it out for me.
I believe it was discussed and noted. However, I would agree with what I'm hearing from the court is that ultimately the judge ordered that mother's rights be terminated based on egregious harm. That is what the actual order on 14 and 15 focuses on, is the egregious harm piece.
Do you agree, Ms. Church, that even with the finding of egregious harm, that doesn't relieve the court of having to do the egregious harm on a prior trial does not relieve the court of having to do a best interest analysis regarding the child that's the subject of the petition?
I would agree. I believe that is fairly clear that best interest is a very important piece of termination no matter what path the termination takes, if it's a bypass such as this one, or if it's a termination after a child protection matter. And I would remind the court that there only needs to be one finding, even if several are alleged in a petition, or even several are discussed in an order, the court only needs to find one reason to terminate, and the court did do that by finding egregious harm of the previous child has is egregious harm to this child, and it would be in child two's best interest to have mother's rights terminated. If for safety, and again, even though the order talks about probably unfit, and that comes right before best interest, there is still best interest analysis about why it is in this child's best interest. It talks about the competing interests of mother versus child, and again, still comes to the conclusion that it is, that terminating mother's parental rights is in the child's best interest.
So I saw in some of the prior pretrial orders where the court relieved the county of its responsibilities to do case planning?
Yes, Your Honor.
But then in conclusion of law number 11, the court notes, mother has demonstrated no ability or desire to follow a case plan for any length of time that requires her to address the pervasive and significant mental health issues, et cetera. It seems inconsistent to me to use that as a conclusion of law as a basis for a finding. I think it's talked about in the context of best interests.
But there can be
yet not require the county to do case planning in the case.
But there's also case planning for, like, you have a mental health case plan or you have a service case plan. So mother did not show an ability to follow any case plan, even her mental health case plans, to follow medication, to follow service providers.
Were there plans?
My understanding is that she had a mental health, she testified about mental health plans that she had. There was not a child protection case plan that came out of Winona County, but she testified about that she was prescribed medication, that she was told to see a therapist, that she was told to do these services for mental health, and whenever she would get stabilized, she would quit doing them, and she testified about and moved to another state, and that was quite frequent. So the county's position is that the case plan meant any case plan she was ever given to follow.
So we're not talking about any recent or current case plans, but rather the history included some of this. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. That was the county's interpretation of that language. So in sum, the county does strongly feel that that even though there was an error in the petition that the county filed, that the court did ultimately review and make an analysis of the proper findings, did find egregious harm. There is only and did talk about best interests and even and made a conclusion that this was in the child's best interest. The county stands that the order is appropriate, and even if the court feels that they needed to make specific findings under the correct numbers, that could be a clerical error, and it could be just requested that the judge amend her order so that the correct statute numbers could be cited. However, it was proper at the time it was done.
And I'm looking at your brief again. I guess, is there any case law for the reasoning that this would be a clerical error and not a reversible error? A clerical error that's not reversible. Is you aware of any case law that we should apply?
I don't believe that I cited any case law. However, in just reviewing this case as a whole, the county feels that that would be the most proper way to review this, given, again, egregious harm was talked about in the petition, egregious harm was talked about throughout the case. It was focused on the previous child, previous sexual assault of child one. There was no dispute about it in any pretrial and any other hearings leading up to that. I would also note that Mr. Nelson said it's a rush, it goes quickly. This case was filed in January, the petition was, the trial wasn't until May. So we were past timelines and out of time. We were past the 60 days that we were supposed to. 60 days does go very fast. However, we were four months into the case, so it was more. They had more time than normally allowed. My time is out. So,
thank you. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Nelson, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing, the panel has addressed the statutory criteria at length. One thing that has not been addressed is the fundamental fairness issue in this particular case. The courts have held that the TPR proceedings should also comply with the fundamental notions of fairness. And in this particular case, my client was deprived of the opportunity to do any kind of case planning due to the respondent's immediate attempt to terminate parental rights, which was based, again, on something that occurred nearly 5 years previous and based on an investigation that occurred while my client was in no position to defend herself or participate. Because of that decision, my client didn't have the opportunity to do the case planning, to participate in services, to go through assessments to determine, first of all, whether she is properly engaged in mental health services that she was involved in at the time, and whether she could continue to safely parent the child. It also deprived my client of the opportunity to simply have visits with the child. There were no allegations that the environment that she was living with that child in at the time was endangered to her or inappropriate in any way or that any.
Where was she living, with her mother?
She was living with her mother at a home in the city of Winona. She'd been there for approximately a year. And again, to reiterate, she was actually engaged in mental health services at the time. And so simply by the respondent choosing to immediately proceed to termination of parental rights without any prior termination of a child's her parental rights to a previous child, without any previous criminal conviction, based simply on an administrative proceeding that occurred in a county in another state, is fundamentally at a time when my client was delusional, is simply fundamentally unfair to my client. All she's asking for is an opportunity to engage in a case plan. And that was denied. And on top of that, she was deprived of any further opportunity to have meaningful time with her child when respondent was relieved of any obligation for reunification. So that's an element of the case that I think also needs to be looked at as well, in addition to all the other procedural errors process that was followed to get to this point. My client is the one that is suffering the consequences of all this. So I would ask that this court reverse the decision of the trial court, remand to Winona County, directing the county to open a child protection case to give my client the opportunity to engage in that case planning. And if she can demonstrate that she can safely parent the child, that's all she's asking for is that chance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing on the internet within 45 days, I believe, for a case of this type. That is the final case on today's oral argument calendar, so the court is now adjourned.